This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company. I have a question for you today. What's your favourite mango? Maybe a Kensington Pride, maybe a Calypso? Send me a text, 0487 993 222. Before 12:30, I'm going to tell you all about a new variety you might see this summer that's been grown right here in Queensland. But first today, the National Farm Chemical Regulator has suspended the registration of popular pesticide dimethylate for the use on blueberries, raspberries and blackberries. The Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority was reviewing the chemical used to kill fruit fly after a surge in consumption of berries. Holders of registrations can apply to continue using it, provided they wait 14 days after spraying to harvest. Industry group Berries Australia Chair Anthony Poyner says the industry accepts the regulator's decision, but says it's going to drive up the cost of berries.
Well, my first reaction is I accept it completely. Secondly, you know, I'm very supportive of them, you know, their focus on ensuring that as our industries evolve, they make sure that they're custodians of keeping consumers safe. So I think that's great, and they're doing their job, so that's good. And particularly in the context of people are eating so many more blueberries, so it's appropriate to look at it. So, you know, I just think, you know, we support their findings. What I don't have is the detail of the research behind, you know, where they landed. You and I spoke before. I touched on the fact that dimethylate's a very unstable compound chemically. So I'm very keen to have a look and see what their research was and how they landed at this decision.
Last time we spoke, you said that if it is suspended in that particular use case, that basically it wouldn't be effective or be able to be used because you're picking berries every 2-3 days and having a longer withholding period basically renders it useless. Is that still your view?
Yeah, we won't be able to use dimethylate in harvest season. No, we won't because, you know, we would harvest on a cycle of about every 7 days. But the withholding period is 14. So we won't be able to apply that during harvest season, no.
And last time you spoke, you said that it would increase costs for growers and potentially for consumers.
Well, dimethylate is very effective against fruit fly, very. It's the most effective tool. But we do use integrated management to control fruit fly. So we will have one less tool in the armour in harvest season without dimethylate, but we'll buckle down and use all of our brilliant agronomists to come up with what the best integrated strategies are going to be.
Is this decision going to cost growers and consumers?
Well, on its face, if we don't do anything about it, yes. But, you know, we'll now apply our minds to adjust our integrated strategies and try and mitigate that.
Yeah, last time we spoke, you were pretty strong on that particular line.
And I remain of the same point. I was hopeful. Look, I don't have access to the research that the APVMA drew from.
I'm just thinking, consumers in the supermarket are thinking, well, am I going to pay an extra $1 or $2 a punnet or am I not?
No, not that much. Not that much. No, not that much. But, look, you know, we're applying new thinking all the time, particularly in pest management. And so, look, the effort has to be accept the quality of what APVMA do, accept their outcome, and put our shoulder to the wheel of how we can best control Queensland fruit fly. That has to be the approach we adopt now. Yeah. We use assassin bugs. We can use different chemicals in, you know, outside of harvest period. We've got a lot of practices in field. It's a pretty fascinating area of science with quite a lot of effort going into it.
Have you heard any feedback from growers on the decision?
No, I have not yet. No, it came out yesterday morning, 8:30 Queensland time, 9:30 my time. And no, I haven't, other than a few colleagues, you know, and look, the feedback I've had is, right, they've come out with their finding, we accept the decision, we move on.
The discussion we had in the lead up to them considering it was a bit more robust.
I wanted to highlight the fact that with a 14-day withholding period for dimethylate, that will mean we cannot use it in harvest season. That is true. But life moves on, and I do respect the APVMA and do respect their findings. I think they would have taken on board my input, which was what we spoke about before. That will render dimethylate unusable in harvest season. I'm sure they'll listen to that. I'm sure of it. I'm sure they'll have taken, the fact that the evolution of how much people are eating blueberries, they'll have taken that into account, and they'll have taken into account the fact that they're going to want to be very, 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 very sure that consumers are safe.
So how's the future of the blueberry industry looking without this key chemical and harvest period?
Look, I'm very optimistic about the future of the industry. We have a huge amount of innovation, a lot of really capable people in our industry. And so when changes like this come along, we take it on and we embrace it and we find new solutions. So I can't tell you exactly what they're going to be right now, but I'm optimistic that we've got a very vibrant industry with a lot of really good minds at work in a good way. I'm very optimistic. I wish we could still use dimethylate, but I accept what the APVMA have come out with. But I don't wish to use it, given what they've come out with. I don't wish to use it now, but I would obviously have liked a very effective chemical to be able to apply in the mix of IPN. I think we're going to have to stay alive to this because the decision has been one for the next 12 months. So I think we've got work to do over the next 12 months to work out the best solutions. Their actual decision was that there were certain products that are no longer registered. And then secondly, for the next 12 months, we can use certain products with a 14-day withholding period. So that's the next 12 months decision. So we've got plenty of work to do.
Anthony Poyner, Chair of Berries Australia, speaking to Brandon Long. Now, the APVMA has been contacted for comment, but in making the announcement, the regulator reiterated that berries remain safe to eat, and it said the surge of consumption had eroded safety margin. While there was no serious risk to human health, it has suspended use as a precaution. Andrew has texted in. It said, there goes the sale of berries. Now the cat's out of the bag on insecticide spraying. He said, I'll stick to only consuming my local organic tropical fruits with a few worms in them. Thanks, Andrew from Noosa. But just also to reiterate what the APVMA has said, that it was a surge in the rates that Australians are eating berries. So we were more exposed to the chemical, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't safe, that this was purely done as a precaution. Up next, the opportunities and momentum we might see in Australia thanks to COP30.
Whether you're running late, just on time, or dreaming of more bedtime, ABC Breakfast. There's never been a better way to start your day. Join us for breakfast weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
So COP30 is on. It's the world's largest climate conference, and there's representatives there from more than 190 countries. This year, Brazil is hosting. Countries attending, like Australia, will spend the next 10 days in negotiations on how to rein in global warming. One of the focuses during the COP30 conference is the transition away from fossil fuels. Peak industry body Bioenergy Australia is hopeful it will result in a global commitment or target for sustainable fuels or low carbon fuels. CEO Shahana McKenzie explains what this will mean for the sector.
We're delighted that there is a strong focus this year on sustainable fuels and low carbon fuels as part of COP30. I think we have seen, quite rightfully so, since the creation of COP, there has been a very strong focus on decarbonisation of the electricity sector globally. And it's really good to see that now there is this focus moving towards low carbon liquid fuels and renewable gases and the significant role that they need to play. So from our perspective, we're delighted that there's a focus this year and looking forward to that having a knock-on positive impact on Australia and the lead up to next year's COP.
What sort of impact can a summit like COP have on an industry like the biofuels and bioenergy industry?
Look, I think it, from our perspective, what it really does is it sets a global ambition, right? And what it does is it sends a signal out globally across the countries to say, this is now an area of focus. This is collectively where we think as those countries that are working together to drive climate change down, that this is now what we need to do. And so what it really does is you know, reinforces the work that the government is already doing in Australia to say, yay, you know, keep going, do more. But it also, you know, it says that other countries that aren't quite yet, you know, sort of setting this as one of the priority focus areas, that this is what they need to be considering. I mean, there's no surprises that that the focus is on low carbon fuels, given, you know, COP this year is in Brazil, one of the leading, you know, kind of global nations in relation to low carbon liquid fuels. So it's great for us that they have been able to get this on the agenda in the way that they have.
Are there any particular policy barriers or international barriers that could be addressed at this summit?
Look, I think the ambition of this COP is really around putting low carbon fuels in the spotlight and having it as one of the priority key areas. The second thing is really around, we're hopeful that there will be some form of a global kind of commitment or target that will be able to be discussed, similar to things such as the Global Methane Pledge and others. So in terms of regulatory barriers and the like, there's a lot of work that's taking place, whether it is across the aviation space, the marine space and other spaces where there is that global usage of these fuels and that intersection with global kind of issues in relation to things like book and claim, you know, certificate of origin schemes, carbon accounting, emissions accounting. All of those things are all areas that there are a range of countries and organisations that are working across the board to drive a consistent approach to that, which is going to be really important. But really for us, COP is around, you know, driving that market development and governments really latching on to the need for focus on this within their own jurisdictions.
Another bigger focus of this COP is about that actual, I guess the actual logistics of a transition away from fossil fuels to sustainable fuels and energy and the impact that can actually have on communities and the importance of employment and retraining people who work in that space to make sure that they're not left behind. What work in that space is happening in Australia?
Look, I mean, we're very much at the beginning of the journey in relation to the development of a low carbon fuels industry. The wonderful thing about these projects and developing a low carbon fuels industry is that it is almost exclusively regional. You know, this is, the feedstocks are coming from regional Australia, whether it's sugarcane, whether it's grains, whether it's algae, whether it's tallow, you know, all of the kind of bio-based feedstocks, forestry, are coming from regional Australia. And so, and for many of those sectors, these are well-established sectors in relation to the feedstock. What we can do with this is actually value add that feedstock in the region. So we can be providing, you know, economic returns into regional Australia, developing thousands of projects across the country. You know, if we're talking about the low carbon fuels and renewable gas projects, we're talking about thousands of jobs. We're talking about an additional 10 billion GDP per annum that could be, you know, driven into regional Australia through developing this industry.
There's a lot of discussion every year at the COP summits about which countries are attending and which countries are not. There's been a lot of discussion this year about whether the United States or whether China is going to send representatives. As someone working in this space, does it actually matter, you know, if these major countries are not going to be there, or is there still enough momentum to drive this forward?
Look, I think that one of the positive things that has happened for us in the last 12 months has been a global recognition of, Australia might be a good place to invest, to do projects. You know, when we're seeing uncertainty in other jurisdictions, such as America, where there has been a lot of investment in low carbon fuel projects, when you start to see, you know, some scepticism there around policy certainty, you know, financial certainty and the like, you know, those large investors and those large project developers sort of take a bit of a look around to say where else potentially could we look at doing a project. And so what we have seen over the last 12 months is absolutely a strong focus from businesses out of the US, but as well as Europe, looking at Australia and sort of saying, hang on, there's a lot of feedstock there. We have a government there that is showing ambition, that has announced some funding, that has announced, you know, moving towards some demand side conversations, and maybe we should be looking to Australia. In relation to COP itself and having, you know, sort of which countries are present and not, I think it does have an impact in relation to if we don't have those large countries that are signing on to these global agendas and commitments, that, you know, that can provide other countries with excuses for not being as ambitious as we need in this space. But for our industry and our industry's perspective, it is all about what our government is doing. That is really what is going to move the dial here.
Bioenergy Australia CEO Shahana McKenzie. Now, agriculture will also be a key focus at the COP30 conference. So a coalition has been launched, the COP30 Declaration to Reform Agri-Food Systems, and it's urging global leaders to tackle emissions, biodiversity loss and the destruction of habitat, while also protecting food production. Professor Johannes Lekutra is a chemical engineer who's working on food security and cellular agriculture at the University of New South Wales. He tells David Claughton there is concern about meat production and its impact on the environment.
Over excessive meat consumption is neither healthy nor good for the planet, but you don't need to abstain completely from eating good and fairly priced meat. So you don't need to have a label on your eating behavior. But if we all as a society anywhere on this planet reduce and optimize our meat consumption, I think that already will be a good idea, yes.
Australia's meat exports are booming, and we're seeing people in third world countries aspire to a more Western diet, more meat rather than less. Which way is it going on a planetary scale? Is meat consumption continuing to rise globally?
The driver is demographics, and as you know, and every talk in my discipline usually starts with those figures. So we are now 2025. We have 5 years to the end of the Sustainability Development Goals, and then by 2050 we are looking at 10 billion people on planet Earth. So there will be more meat consumption, and if you then translate that into being healthy or not healthy for the planet, just look at planet Earth as a living organism. There will be more people on planet Earth who will need more food. At the same time, people like to eat meat and should eat good food. And all of those additional 2 billion people are certainly fully entitled to have good and nutritious food. And we do know that fruits and vegetables can be very nourishing and healthy. Yes,
we produce a lot of grains, a lot of plant-based food as well. But you're a chemical engineer, so how much can that alternative protein sector help to deliver what a growing population will need, do you think?
First and foremost, it needs to work, and it needs to be functional, and it needs to to be feasible. What I'm saying here is it needs to be able to deliver in the first place. I mean, we can talk a lot and we can come up and hallucinate about many things, but it has to work. It also has to be affordable. It has to be convenient. It has to be liked by consumers. So
there it's still are pretty many, small, isn't it, in terms of the Australian
absolutely market.
You know, what people are choosing in the supermarket, about 12% of things have got, you know, a plant element to it, but consumption of alternative proteins, you know, things made in a biolab, for example, cellular meat or even, you know, meat-like substances made out of plant-based things, that's still very small.
Absolutely. And look at people who need to make ends meet. And if you then have a choice between deforesting land and putting a cow on the meadow versus running complicated bioreactor-based systems with all kinds of biotech complexity, you will go for the traditional way to feed your children, and that is just the normal way.
Well, even the carbon footprint of all that technology, you know, cranking around trying to produce food in a different way is not particularly good for the planet either, is it?
And I think here we're still missing data, to be fair. We're missing data and we're missing insight and we're missing all of the evidence, and it remains to be seen.
And in Australia, we've heard from companies that they say they're struggling in the alternative protein sector to get up the facilities they need to produce this food in a bioreactor or a precision fermenter, or, you know, with all that tech gear that we've just been talking about. Is Australia ever going to overcome those problems, do you think, and become a major processor or producer of alternative proteins?
That depends. That is not just a little interview. That is a whole series of lectures and discussions with experts, David. But we are struggling here with our advanced manufacturing sector, like for years already, and we have very little self-confidence to lift ourselves out of this. So if we now go abroad and look into other economies and into other countries where value-added manufacturing works much better, we also see that these modern food tech technologies don't really get a lot of grip. So old saying, proverb, Rome wasn't built in a day. So it is worthwhile to keep doing research, and it is worthwhile to keep investigating and to push for R&D, but it is unrealistic to expect or to promise that our supermarket shelves will be looking different by the end of the year or in 2 years from now. That's not
There'll
happening.
There'll be sheep and cattle in the paddocks for many years
there
to come.
There you go. That's it.
Johannes Lekutra from the University of New South Wales speaking to David Claughton. Now, I'll keep you updated on any announcements from COP30. It is 28 minutes past 12. Up next, the newest variety of mango about to hit supermarket shelves.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
I want to hear from you today on your favourite type of mango. You can send me a text on 0487 993 222. So Gay has texted in and said, when any variety of mango ripens naturally, they have their own beautiful natural taste. The weather is warming up, and I have to say, I think it's one of my favourite things about summer. It's the fruit, including mangoes. And there's a lot of different varieties out there. I was really lucky a few years ago when I was a rural reporter in Bundaberg to go to a mango tasting. I went to this property where they grew dozens of different mango varieties. It was just something that they did for fun, just to have them. And I can't remember what the exact variety was called, but my favorite on the day, it was one that you eat green. So you eat before it ripens, and it's sort of grown and it's used, I think, a lot for Asian dishes that have green mango in them, those sort of salads that have the green mango in them. And it was honestly, I think that was one of my favorite days I've ever had in this job. It's really memorable. I just spent a whole day eating mango and talking to people about mango. But this year, this summer, there's a whole new variety. Not only is it grown exclusively in Queensland, it was also developed here, and you'll probably get to try it before the end of the month. Sophie Johnson has this story.
There is nothing quite like biting into a golden, juicy mango on a hot summer's day. For the first time this year, the new Ruby Gold variety has been produced to commercial volumes. John Nardi is the business manager for tropical fruits with Favco, a family-owned fruit and vegetable wholesaler. He has been working with the Ruby Gold growers, who are based in Dimbula in far north Queensland, about 100 kilometres southwest of Cairns. Mr. Nardi says there are a few things that set these mangoes apart.
Typically has a really nice ruby, maroony sort of maroon sort of blush to it, so it looks fantastic. So when it's ripened, it's got that beautiful blush on a nice sort of yellow-orange background. So really has really looks fantastic. And it's just got a really good strong KP-type flavour, which is what we all love. Typically a bit stronger than normal Kensington Pride, so yeah, it's a little less fibrous as well, so not quite as stringy. So, yeah, you know, it's a fantastic variety. We think it's going to do very well. So far, feedback that we've had from some of the product testing and trialling that we've done has been amazing. So, yeah, we think it'll do really well in the market. And, yeah, it'll be a great new thing for mango lovers.
The Ruby Gold came about naturally on farm. And for the past decade, Mr. Nardi has helped the growers, the Palumbo family, to develop the variety.
So when the growers identified the variety, it was different. My understanding is it was pretty much just a branch on a normal Kensington Pride tree, a random branch that had this slightly different looking fruit. It was with a bit more blush and it had a slightly stronger flavour. It's a typical Kensington Pride shape as well that we're used to as Australians. So it does look very familiar in that respect. They then worked in taking grafts off that branch and then producing more trees, and yeah, they've just grown with it from there. They've got it registered, so it has got plant breeders' rights, so it is identified as its own variety. It has been different enough to be called its own variety, so it has its own PBR is what we call it, for plant breeders' rights, and it's grown over the years from there. They've got more plantings in the ground and starting to enter into some semi-commercial volumes this year.
The Ruby Gold Mango is a premium product, and with 15,000 trays expected this season, marketing agents are getting excited. Like Peter Tran, who is a Melbourne-based agent and director of Produce of Virginia.
Well, I'll do a bit of business with Favco, just marketing their KPs and their R2E2s as well. And when they mentioned that there was a new variety coming through the market that they wanted to try and trial in Melbourne, I was more than keen to put my hand up and give it a crack.
Over the past 2 years, he has been a part of Mr. Nardi's trials, bringing smaller amounts of the Ruby Gold variety to independent supermarkets and retailers. He says consumers can't get enough of it, but he's not surprised. He says he knew it was going to be a high-performing variety from the first batch.
Oh, well, it's the first pallet that arrived. When me and my staff took down a tray, I was blown away by the blush on the skin. It was incredible. Every single piece had this beautiful ruby blush. And once we put it into the ripening rooms, and after 3 or 4 days checking up on the fruit, the golden colour of the skin really popped, really contrasted with the ruby gold blush. It was amazing. And once we had a taste of it, I was like, this is a winner. This can't be beaten. There are some things you just know as an agent, you know what will sell, what will do well, what will do badly. But this variety of mango, when we saw it, we were like, yep, that's a winner.
Mr. Tran says the fruit has a number of attractive features.
It holds very well. It's similar to an R2E2 in terms of shelf life and firmness of flesh, but also with the benefits of being a KP genetic, it tastes even better than a KP. So the best of both worlds. Just looking at the fruit and just feeling the firm flesh, you know that their shelf life is probably at least 50% longer than the KPs.
Picking for this season's crop is underway this week, with the fruit expected to hit supermarket shelves soon after.
That report from Sophie Johnson. I will have to say I'm very, very excited to try this variety, and I'm going to be keeping an eye out for it. So hopefully I can find it here in central Queensland. Had some texts come through about people's favourite mangoes. Terry said, if you can imagine a mango that appears to have a tiny fizz in its flesh, then you have one called Honey Gold, the ultimate in a mango. It sustains life. Thank you so much for your text, Terry. 0487 993 222 if you want to tell me what your favourite mango is. Weather's up next.
What's complex, brilliant, and has more than 200 years of rollicking backstory? Our Australian electoral system. Join me to investigate.
Annabelle Crabb's Civic Duty. Stream all the episodes on ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's time to check in on the weather, and Baden Gilbert joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Baden.
Afternoon. Hope you're doing well.
I hope you are too. So what can we expect over coming days?
Yeah, so we could start with what's happening today and what's happened over the past 24 hours or so. We've got some cloud on the satellite from about Rockhampton northwards along eastern districts, with some shower activity in that from around Proserpine through to around Cairns at the moment, as well as some showers and storms about far northern Cape York Peninsula into Torres Strait. And up that way, we had some pretty decent showers and storms yesterday as well, with some places getting above 20 millimetres. And even in Torres Strait, one lonely weather gauge picking up more than 100 millimetres from a series of very slow-moving showers and storms. So a bit of a change up there, a bit more moisture in play and a bit more showers in play. But the good news is that that has taken the heat out of the heatwave warning that we'd had been having up there for the past couple of weeks. So that has now fallen off. Still some low-intensity heat up there, but not quite as severe as it was in previous days. Okay, so that's pretty much today sorted. There's a little bit of cloud around the southeast as well up towards Gurry, but nothing too much to bother anyone with. As we go into tomorrow, we're expecting that storm risk to stretch pretty much through the middle vertically of Queensland, from Cape York down through the northern and central interior, down towards Roma and Charleville. There could be some gusty storms in that as well about the central interior during Thursday. Then things pick up a bit more from Friday onwards. We have a bit more storm activity and shower activity about the southeastern interior, including the Darling Downs and surrounding areas. That will be the focus area for Friday for those showers and storms. Before into the weekend, we get a broad band roughly from the northwest of the state around Mount Isa through the central interior down towards the Darling Downs will be the focus for Saturday, and that will pick up a bit more heat and move a bit more eastwards as it moves into Sunday, before reaching the east coast on Monday and starting to largely clear on Tuesday. So a bit going on, and there's sort of a day-by-day narrative to it, but that broadly sets up the coming most of the week for Queensland, really, with almost all the state potentially getting a bit of a drink from some of these showers and storms.
Yeah. Is there much in the way of totals in this lot of rain?
In terms of precipitation totals for the next couple of days, I think probably the best way to describe it is that apart from bits of the far southwest, from Friday through to Monday, most of the state could see at least 25 millimetres in some of those higher end totals in the rain gauges in your area. And I imagine some spots will pick up a bit more than that as well. Some of the localised thunderstorms that could be embedded in these showers over the next 4 or 5 days or so could potentially have some moderate to locally heavy falls in them. So we'll be watching for that, particularly on the weekend.
Is there any indication at all yet whether or not these thunderstorms might be severe in the way of hail or lightning or anything like that?
In terms of hail and wind, potentially there's a bit of a risk about the southern interior and the Darling Downs on Friday that some of those storms could have a wind and hail risk. So that will be something that we're monitoring closely as we go into Friday. For the weekend, perhaps more the risk would shift towards getting that heavy rainfall rather than the wind and hail. They tend to not be all three unless it's a really big thunderstorm. So that will be a shift in focus for the weekend, where we could see those localised heavy falls come into play.
And I saw today that there was a few high fire dangers about. Is that anything to be concerned about?
Yeah, so for today, as we've had the last couple of days, it has been pretty dry through the interior. Some really unusually low dew points, actually, and humidities out through the western Queensland. They're getting a little bit better, but just with the last hints of that, we do have some higher fire dangers, particularly about the northwest of the state for today. They will ease back into tomorrow, though, and we will have some high fire dangers on the forecast for the rest of the week. But by the time we get to Sunday, those showers will really put a dampener on that, and we're expecting to go back to moderates across the state.
And just quickly, in coastal waters, how are winds and swells looking?
We have had a bit of a southerly change move through southern parts of the state. That change is just making its way past Goree now. So there is some strong winds associated with that for the Goree Coast, the Sunshine Coast, as well as the Gold Coast waters. That will be a pretty transient feature, though, and will sort of weaken out as we go through today. A little bit of southerly swell with that as well for water south of Goree, but nothing too abnormal for this time of year. And winds are much lighter further north, with just some lighter trade flow in play for far north Queensland.
Baden, thank you so much for your time today.
That's a good. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Baden Gilbert, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
I want to hear from you today on your favourite types of mango. You can send me a text on 0487 993 222. Ray said, my favourite mango is any that is peeled and cut by somebody else. That's fair. Otherwise, I'm not that fussed on them. I think they're overrated. Many more fruits I prefer over mangoes. Ray, that might be a bit of a controversial opinion, but fair enough. Let me know, what are your preferred fruits? What's your favourite summer fruit, Ray? Send me a text. Barry from Mara said, it's got to be the KP or the good old Bowen. Tony Greig, cricket commentator, famously said that the Brisbane cricket test was his favourite because he could get a heap of mangoes and sit in a bathtub and quietly slop away at them. Thank you so much for your text messages today, and keep them coming. I'd love to hear from you. But one of the other big summer crops in Queensland that we have is sorghum. I've actually heard the crop described by some growers before as Captain Reliable, as most years growers can get some pretty good yields. Now, this crop is in the spotlight because the Grains Research and Development Corporation has come together with the University of Queensland to form a sorghum strategic alliance. So $13 million is going to be spent over 7 years on research. GRDC General Manager for Applied Research Development and Extension, Craig Bailey, along with Agriculture Food Innovation Director, Professor Matthew Morell, and UQ Centre for Crop Science Director, Professor Ian Godwin, made the announcement at the TropAg Conference in Brisbane.
What this new alliance allows us to do is to continue that work over a seven-year run rate way, so a really long amount of time that we can generate some significant R&D that will transform our industry. So some foundation programs that we're now looking to launch around new genetics, as Ian has mentioned, but also then translating that potential in the field through new agronomy. Some of the genetic improvements that we're looking at is in the lab or on the glasshouse is, you know, 30% improvements in yield, but also being able to extract greater protein out of feed sources for animal food as well. Drought tolerance is also a key feature there, but also extracting value when we do have good seasons. So breeding varieties that we can capitalise on their genetic potential when we have a good season. And as we know, farmers tend to make their profits in the good seasons and tend to hold in the dry seasons. So we've kind of got that sort of broad spectrum of activity from the genetic technologies right through to the agronomy and translating that to outcomes in the field for farmers in their hip pocket and ultimately their profitability.
Oh, look, I think I'd also add that one of the features of this program from the university's point of view is that it allows us to build a stronger and more enduring capability in terms of the scientific research to support the GRDC and through the GRDC, the farmers. We're also working closely in this alliance with the Queensland Department of Primary Industries. So we're able to bring that connected, stronger capability, as Craig said, over a seven-year time period. And that's really important to solve some of the major challenges that we're addressing here.
I'm sure you'd be aware a lot of growers in the Darling Downs have challenges around fall armyworm and more recently sort of storm damage or damage from waterlogging. What can you tell us about the sort of research going on in those spaces and how this investment will help?
Yeah, I guess the alliance is you know, the pinnacle, if you like, of our investment in sorghum, but there's obviously other things that the grains industry is investing in around that. But again, you know, the key part of this program is balancing that genetic technology, so that's what we call upstream investments, cutting-edge technology, to more the downstream, you know, practical application on farm about realising that potential. So those sort of factors that limit, farming practices on the ground and achieving that yield potential, they're sort of addressed through the farming systems work, which will also be a key feature of this program as well.
Are you going to be working on GMO varieties that are resistant to fall armyworm?
We won't be as part of this program at the moment, but perhaps one of these gentlemen might want to speak to that.
The fall armyworm issue, definitely GM would be one potential solution, but I think there's some pretty good other solutions in terms of management systems as well that will really help with regards to fall armyworm. We are doing quite a lot of gene editing work as part of two of the projects that are planned, but those are predominantly aimed at grain quality and yield per se, as Craig has alluded to, increasing protein content for our major end users, the poultry and the pig industries. So we're hopeful that some of those will actually lead to more on-farm profitability and make sorghum an even more attractive crop for many of the growers in the region. I mean, sorghum's tough, but as we know, the climate's getting tougher.
Are planting techniques part of the research as well?
Planting techniques in the terms of managing the field and the farming systems, yes. Most of the soils that sorghum is grown on, the planting techniques are pretty well understood by most of our growers, and in fact much of the on-farm research in that has actually come from grower networks.
Sorghum is predominantly grown in northeast Australia. Would this work create varieties that could be grown elsewhere?
Yeah, sort of part of the program, particularly around the agronomy piece, is to close the yield gap. So looking at, you know, what genetic potential is, but also how do you close that in terms of what you achieve in the field. And a large component of that is to look at cooler areas as well. So expanding the production into some of the cooler regions. So we talked about the northern, more, you know, hotter environments and more challenging environments, but certainly, yes, into the more southern systems as well. Some of the other work that we're doing within these initiatives is about, you know, again, the protein is about replacing other imported sources of animal food. So that's another aspect of what we're trying to do in terms of value add as well.
We'd be looking at sorghum over the 7-year horizon for biofuels?
It could be a possibility, but at the moment we've got a foundation program around these four projects, and what the Alliance allows us to do is build out that project or that program over time. So we don't put any limitations on where we might go to. That's one of the really unique ways in which we develop the Alliance. Mm-hmm. It gives us that long term, as I said before, which builds capacity within the research teams, but it also gives us an opportunity to explore other areas as well that complement the main program. So whilst it's not currently within in the scope of what we've currently got, it's certainly within
part of the Alliance.
Yesterday we launched the ARC Centre for the Replacement of Fossil Fuels in Plants. So that is a vehicle in which we are conducting research on using sorghum and sugarcane, mm-hmm, predominantly for fossil fuel replacement. So there's a really great synergy between this GRDC investment and that Australian Research Council investment.
I just wanted to add on the biofuel thing. I'm not using AI here, I'm just using I, but I think based on the amount of demand for grain sorghum, it's unlikely in the near future that any grain sorghum is going to go into biofuel. Mm-hmm. But once you harvest the grain, you've still got more than 50% of the biomass still standing, mm-hmm, in the field, and that could well be something that, like sugarcane, becomes a major part of the biofuel industries.
Yep. With countries like the US facing droughts, is there demand for Australian sorghum to be exported, or is there too much of a shortage to share it overseas?
At the moment, China is our biggest target for export, and a lot of that probably goes into their national drink, baijiu, and that's a very lucrative market, which is actually targeted by a number of growers and grower cooperatives. And yes, there are a lot of potential export markets for sorghum at the moment, and part of this strategic partnership is the demand is so high that we could probably double production easily and it wouldn't have any effect on price because we would have people who are taking it.
What have the major barriers been up until now about expanding that production then?
Probably seasonal influences and other crops, I guess. But, you know, where we see sorghum is a mainstay, it's our largest producing summer crop. So I guess, you know, it's about where we can expand into new areas. As mentioned before, there's opportunity to go into cooler climates, maybe even the north into more warmer climates. But also just realising the genetic potential that's there, right? So there's that gap between, you know, what potential is in the seed to what you actually realise in the bin, and trying to close that gap. And there's, you know, quite a large opportunity to increase yields through that, through this initiative.
GRDC General Manager Applied Research Development and Extension Craig Bailey, along with Agriculture and Food Innovation Director Matthew Morrell and UQ Centre for Crop Science Director Professor Ian Godwin.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Ray has texted back in to let me know what his favourite summer fruit is, given he's not the biggest fan of mangoes, and he said blood plums are his favourite summer fruit. And Andrew from Bundaberg said zespri golden kiwi fruit is his. Thank you for your texts on the Country Hour today. I want to introduce you to someone now, one of three new biosecurity vets who are working to help protect Queensland's livestock industry against biosecurity risks. So they'll be working for the Department of Primary Industries in Cairns, Charters Towers and Charleville. Courtney Scott grew up in the Channel Country and has recently relocated to Charleville to take on her role as operational veterinarian. She spoke with Madeline McCosker about the new role.
Yes, so I've recently started with the department here in Charleville as an operational veterinarian. Myself and two other vets have started, one in Charters Towers and one in Cairns. So my experience, I've been in the private veterinary sector for nearly 8 years before starting this role, and grew up on a cattle station out at Windora, a family property out there. So that sort of experience is sort of what's driven me to move into this role, to really try and help people on a bigger scale, having previous experience and understanding in the industry and the challenges that people face.
And I'm really keen to touch on your previous experience because, you know, I think you'd probably have a pretty ingrained understanding of the importance of biosecurity growing up on a property in the Channel Country. So I guess how has that experience and growing up within the agricultural industry shaped you as a vet and I guess helped you move towards this kind of role?
Yeah, definitely. I think having grown up in the industry, really have an understanding of the challenges that producers face and the importance of biosecurity in safeguarding our industry. Exports and our markets are so valuable for all of our agricultural industry. And not only that, but just I guess what drove me to apply for this role too was being able to assist in emergency situations like the recent Western Queensland flooding and being there to assist with those sort of welfare situations and things as well. And I think it's just a fantastic opportunity to be able to safeguard our industry going forward.
There has been an increased focus on biosecurity and in the concerns, you know, around animal diseases coming into Australia, especially in, you know, the last 3 to 5 years. How do you think your experience within the industry is going to play into that role that you now have? And I guess, how do you think it's going to assist in moving forward in the industry while also keeping a really close eye on those animal diseases that we are obviously still very concerned about in the agricultural industry?
There is an increased awareness or risk with these biosecurity issues. Foot and mouth disease, lumpy skin disease are all really a risk to our northern industries. They're sort of just there on our doorstep. And I think it's really important to have a good connection with the local area to build that trust with people. And I'm so fortunate, having grown up in the area and already know a lot of people, that I hope that people will feel comfortable to come to me and to the other vets that have started with the department with concerns, because, you know, they're on the ground seeing things every day. And the sooner that we can get on top of these and come out and investigate, and if it is something that's reportable or nasty, then the sooner that we can get on top of it, the better, and the less risk for our market access and the cost to our industry.
You mentioned earlier you've got quite a bit of experience in the veterinary industry, almost 8 years, and that's across different states and in rural and remote areas. So I guess having a good understanding of what this job entails across all of those different parts of the country. How do you think that experience is going to help you in this role?
Yeah, I think I'm very, very fortunate to have had a breadth of experience across the private veterinary sector, mostly in mixed practice, and as you said, in sort of a couple of different states as well. And private vets are really the forefront of biosecurity as well. They're often the first point of call that a producer will ring to get advice, and so we really work alongside private vets. They're our partners in managing in biosecurity risks, and we can support them in disease investigation, diagnostic testing, and biosecurity information. So I'm definitely fortunate to have those contacts from my previous experience in the private veterinary space as well. Biosecurity is a shared responsibility for everyone. So, you know, looking out, reporting and protect are the three things that that we look out for. So, yeah, look, report, protect. If you have any concerns or want some more information, then you can call the department on 13 25 23. Or we also have our emergency animal disease hotline, which you can report suspected disease to, which is 1-800-675-888. We're always here to help, and as I said, we really want to be there to support people if they do have concerns or to answer any questions about biosecurity.
Courtney Scott Chalaville's new operational veterinarian with the Department of Primary Industries, speaking to Madeline McCosker. It's time to head to the markets now, and first up, the Dalby cattle sale, where David Friend has the details.
With slight increase in numbers, Dalby agents yarded 5,388, which included 784 from Far Western Queensland and 267 from New South Wales. All the regular buyers attended and very active. A quality lineup of cattle pen at the time of this interim report, the market strong for all categories. Yearling steers over 480 kilos to 504 to lot feeders. Yearling heifers 330-400 kilos also improved to lot feeders to 492 cents a kilo. Growing steers over 600 kilos to 479 cents a kilo to process. Growing heifers over 540 kilos to 457 cents to processors. A quality yarding of well-conditioned cows pen. The two score cows 400 to 520 kilos to 348 cents a kilo. The three score cows over 520 kilos to 420. Bulls 450 to 600 to 422. And bulls over 600 kilos to 422 cents a kilo as well. This has been David Pham from the National Livestock Reporting Service at Dalby.
Over to the Charters Towers Selling Centre with Mick Kingham.
Good afternoon. In very humid conditions, the supply of cattle lifted to 3,046 head in a combined prime and store sale. Buyer attendance was good with the return of additional southern processor and opportunity feeders. Quality improved on last sale with an increased number of prime yearlings, heavy prime steers, more than 1,000 cows and nearly 350 bulls. Cattle were drawn from Mount Isa to Croydon and south to the Ballyando. At the time of this interim report, very strong demand pushed values higher for most categories. Trade yearling heifers lifted 20 to 50 cents. Prime grown steers improved 4 to 23. Prime heifers rose by up to 30 cents. Cows increased 7 to 17. And bullocks were firmed to 20 cents better. Yearling steers to trade sold from 438 to 446. Similar heifers to trade made from 382 to 428. Prime grown steers above 400 kilos sold to 440. Heavy grown steers above 500 kilos reached 452 multiple times to average 438 to 444. Prime grown heifers to processors sold from 386 to 430. Heavy four-score bullocks to export slaughter topped at 448. A good sample averaging from 426 to 446. Medium weight two-score cows to processors reached 374 to average 365. Three scores sold to 396 to average 375. And a good supply of prime heavyweight cows topped at 418 to average from 394 to 411. Heavy bulls to processors made to 396. This is Mick Kingham from Charters Towers from National Livestock Reporting Service.
And Richard Thompson reports from the Graysmere Selling Centre.
Good afternoon, listeners. CQLX yarding increased by 165 head to 2,315 today. Quality as usual was mixed, but a better quality offering than last week. There are very few heavy cows in the lineup today, although plain cows have sold well, driven by the restockers and processors. Only a few feeder steers have been sold at the time of this report, with the best selling to 449 cents. Processors paid to 457 for their bullocks to average 429 to 454. Trade heifers made to 427 and average 395 to 401. Two score cows sold to 381 and averaged from 362 to 381. Heavy four-score cows averaged 404 cents, and heavy bulls topped at 389 to average 375 cents to processors. This has been Richard Thompson for the National Livestock Reporting Service of the MLA from Gracemere.
That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company and so much for your text messages. Always a pleasure to hear from you. News is coming up. It's 1 o'clock.